You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Screens of the Stone Age, the podcast where scientists review movies about prehistoric people. My name is Dr. Joshua Lindell. I am a paleoanthropologist studying Neanderthals. Still haven't worked out the description.
I think Ross says it different every time, too.
And I'm here with...
I am Dr. Kimberly Plump. I am a bioarchaeologist. I study the human skeleton, health and disease, and evolution.
And I'm Dr. Ross Barnett, interested in ancient DNA and Pleistocene megafauna.
And today we are in November, but we are recording an episode that will go up on December 21st, the winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere. Long night. Yeah. And we are today reviewing an episode of the TV show Cavemen from 2007, I believe. We've already covered the intro, the first episode of this series. And so if you want to hear a more general review of this series, go check out that episode. I'll put a link in the show notes. Today we're reviewing episode 8 or 9?
19, I think.
Depending on...
9?
Not 19. There weren't 19 episodes of this show.
That's why I couldn't find it on YouTube.
Did I write 19 in the email?
I don't know. Probably not. I just went and used your link after I couldn't find it.
The episode is called Caveman Holiday, and so this is the episode where the cavemen are celebrating their winter holiday, which they call Long Night. And of course, this series was the series based on the Geico insurance commercials featuring a caveman, often on the lists of worst TV series of all time. We'll see how we feel about that after a second episode of it. Who wants to summarize this episode for us?
I can do it, but I never remember anybody's names or details. But so... it opens up to the four roommates, right? And so two of them are brothers, and you kind of have like the leader go-getter guy, and he works at a Norwegian ripoff of IKEA. And then there is his younger brother, who's kind of like the dumb but sweet hyper guy, I think. And then there's the guy that's working on his PhD, right? And he was the one that was funny in the first episode, and he's kind of the jerk. And then there's another guy, but I don't even know that I know who he is. Is there a fourth guy, or is it just the three of them?
There is. He is a friend of theirs who's more of a side character. He comes to their Long Night party later, and I think he's the one who tells the story at Long Night.
Right, okay. So that guy that I don't even have a description for him, I don't know.
He's just a bit sleazy.
Yeah. So it opens up, and the academic guy is... for some reason, stabbing pencils into an orange, and he's like putting his Oz focus on that. And then we find out, so the younger brother is really excited because he realizes he's talking to his mom, and he realizes that Long Night is this Thursday, not next Thursday. And so he gets really excited about it. And it's going to be his first long night away from home. So he's really excited. He wants to get all the cooking done, get all the presents for everybody, and have a celebration. His brother is not really that into it. He thinks that it's for kids. He doesn't really want to do it. And then he gets invited at his work to host some businessmen that are visiting from Korea that want to open up a fake IKEA in Korea. And so he gets asked. So like his boss is kind of grooming him to be the next boss because he's been working so hard because his girlfriend dumped him. And so he's been throwing himself into work. So he's... not going to go to Long Night because he has to like stay and meet with the Korean businessmen and show them around his shift, I guess. And then the academic guy, he's not really into it until he starts noticing that the young guy's doing everything wrong. So he's cooking things wrong. He's doing things wrong. And then he just completely takes over the whole night because he wants it done a certain way. And the details of the night are kind of funny. Like it's gross things, like the peaches need to be rotten. And so they say, you know, you put chocolate chip mint ice cream on it so it looks like mold. And he was like, that's not how you do it. It has to be actually rotten. And they have to get, you know, the pieces of meat and cow a certain way. And so the story behind Long Night, the myth behind Long Night, is kind of a mix between American Canadian Thanksgiving and Christmas, but with a caveman twist. So the idea is that they had was the longest, coldest night in history, and a lot of the cavemen almost died, or they all almost died. But then this mystical cow came and fed everybody for the whole night or something. So this one cow was able to feed everybody in the whole world in one night. So it's like Santa Claus. And so they were able to survive the night, the cold, long night. And so that's where they give their thanks and they all come together. And the rules of it are that you invite everybody that you know to your long night party, even if you hate them, everybody is welcome. It's kind of a night where you put aside all of those, you know, bad relationships and stuff. And so they're getting ready for it. It smells really bad. The neighbor, the kind of like racist against cavemen neighbor, shows up and asks them if they're cooking a homeless person, is it, that she asked?
Did she say tramp?
Or derelict? I think she said,
I missed that.
Are you cooking?
God.
I think she was like, are you cooking a derelict?
Vagrant.
Vagrant, yes.
Vagrant.
Are you cooking a vagrant? And so the food, all the food that they're making sounds disgusting. Like, it's all kind of rotten and cooked weird because it would have been, I guess, back in the day. And then not only back in the day, like in prehistoric times, but also the last of the food that they had. So like rotten peaches and all that. So the little brother's really disappointed because it doesn't feel like Long Night's Eve because his brother's not there and the party's not really going the way he wants it. And then the guy, brother at IKEA, has this like moment of realization that he wants to be home. He wants to celebrate Long Night. And so he runs away from work and leaves and goes to Long Night. There wasn't really much like build up to that. Like, he didn't really have any emotion wrapped up in that with him. But anyway, so he shows up at Long Night. His brother gets really happy. The academic guy ends up sleeping again with this woman who was kind of introduced, I think, in the first episode as being kind of like their stalker. Like, they all kind of hate her, but she's always around. And it's kind of mean, I guess. And then obviously the IKEA guy sleeps with his ex-girlfriend. And I think that's about it. Right? Did I miss anything?
And Andy, who's the younger, enthusiastic brother, he ends up sleeping with his brother's ex-girlfriend's friend. So everyone ends up with somebody on Long Night.
Oh, right. And then his mom phones in the morning and he tells her right away. He's like, oh, mom, she's naked in my bed. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same thing where I didn't hate watching it, but it's just, it's almost funny, but it's just missing. Like, it's just not quite there. And it's almost could be a good show, but they just were missing something. It's just not quite enough. I don't want to watch another episode.
Once.
Yeah. I don't remember at what, but I remember laughing.
I laughed at there was actually a pretty good line where Andy, I think, no, yeah, Joel, the younger brother, who is cooking the cow heart in the microwave, which kind of stinks out the whole building. And then the anti-caveman neighbor comes to visit and he invites her to Long Night and tells her to bring her appetite. And she says, it'll be right here where I lost it.
Yeah.
which was actually a pretty good line. I thought it was quite good.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know, like, it's similar stories to every sitcom, right? But there's just something lacking. Like, even you didn't really feel you didn't feel anything about the guy missing Long Night. Like, I don't know. It's like, I don't know what's missing in the show, but something's missing, but they were so close to having a good one.
Yeah.
And like the first episode that we watched was the pilot. And so I kind of thought, because a lot of pilots are awkward and not really get very good, right?
We didn't actually watch the pilot, I believe. We watched the first episode, but the pilot had a very, very similar story, but they changed a lot from the pilot because the pilot got such bad criticism. So in the actual pilot episode, the show is set in Atlanta, I think, which is why so many of the actors have Southern accents, even though the series ended up actually being set in San Diego. And Joel, in the episode we watched, Joel wants to propose to his girlfriend, who is a Homo sapiens. In the pilot episode, he's going to a fancy rich person party that her parents are hosting, and he's asking them to marry their daughter there, but the sort of racial tension is amped up because they're like Southern rich white people and he's the caveman, and it's like way more of that like parody for the episode we watched was not actually the pilot. The pilot was much worse than any of the other episodes we've seen.
How did it get made? I remember the first one was kind of funny with the storyline of like that she might have had a kink for like a fetish for Neanderthals or cavemen. Yeah. That was funny. Yeah, I remember that.
So here's something interesting. The show overall on IMDb has a rating of 4.4 out of 10.
Wow, that's high for what it is.
Well, the episode we just watched, which is on IMDb numbered episode 9, Caveman Holiday, has an 8.1 out of 10.
No, people are just feeling terrible in the holidays.
Is that the best for the whole season?
Well, I'm looking at it right now, and I'm kind of surprised that that pilot that I just told you about that we didn't actually watch also has an 8.1 out of 10 somehow.
Wow.
The first episode, which we did watch, has a 5.6 out of 10. So somehow the pilot, which was like universally panned and then they rewrote it, has a much higher rating on IMDb than the actual first episode. And I'm wondering, maybe that's just people reacting to it like 20 years after the fact and being like, oh, this isn't that bad. I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10, you know?
Mm. Yeah. Certainly in the YouTube comments of the clips that I saw, there was a lot of very positive people saying this is the best sitcom ever. And they were really upset that it got canceled. Now, I don't know if they were being ironic, but I'm guessing
yeah,
not.
Sarcasm doesn't really come across. I mean, like, I said it before. They had a good idea. The execution was just missing something.
I don't think that this is one of the worst sitcoms of all time. It's always on these lists of like top 10 worst shows. It's not that bad.
No, it's not. You can sit through it, but you're going to forget it and you're not going to.
It's short as well, which is also a blessing.
Yeah.
And this one had French Stewart in it, famously from Third Rock from the Sun, who plays the IKEA boss.
He used to be in so much stuff and now he's not in anything.
It took me a while to kind of place him because he looks a bit different. His eyes are wider now. I don't know, is that surgery or is it just a character choice?
I think it was a facelift is what it looked like to me.
But yeah, he was one of the better characters in this episode. When you kind of discover that he's living in the store eating microwave meals and that kind of prompts Andy to go back to Long Night. That was kind of, there was some bathos there. It was just quite nice.
Yeah. So he's like, oh, you could have my life. You can have this job. You could be me in a few years. And then he finds him like eating a microwavable dinner. Yeah.
But not his special orthopedic shoes.
No.
So what can we comment on this episode? We've already sort of commented on the caveman prosthetics. We've commented on a lot of the, you know, the caveman stuff in our previous episode on this show. We probably don't want to say the same thing over again.
Mm.
So what do we have particular to this episode that we can discuss?
Well, what I thought would be quite interesting to discuss is Neanderthal diet. Mm. Because the long night is very much meat-centered. Mm-hmm. Kind of cow-centered. So I thought we could talk a bit about Neanderthal diet because there has been some really interesting research on that topic come out recently. I'm happy to kind of wade right in if anyone else wants to.
Yeah, go for it. And then I'll add if I've got anything in my notes that you don't cover, I'll add it to what you've got.
Yeah, so it's really interesting to see when they're doing the shopping for Long Night, they're basically having a shopping trolley full of just meat. It's just all kinds of meat and offal and, you know, all the kind of bits of a cow. I mean, they could almost put a whole cow back together.
Well, I think that's what they were trying to do because he grabbed head meat and he was like, does this work as the skull or?
The mystical cow. And they talk about, you know, putting cow tongue in their punch or something as well. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, there is definitely evidence for Neanderthals being what's termed hypercarnivores. So the very top of the food chain eating the same kind of diet as cave lions, wolves, saber-tooths that were around at the same time as them. And a lot of that work is kind of based on isotope studies, so dietary isotopes, mm-hmm. particularly on dietary nitrogen. So the basis of this is that almost every element has isotopes that form naturally. So people are familiar with carbon-14 as an isotope of carbon-12. There's also carbon-13 as well. Mm-hmm. Nitrogen, another element that's part of the food chain, exists mostly as nitrogen-14, but there is a small percentage that's nitrogen-15. And that kind of the ratio stays more or less constant in nature. And of course, carbon and nitrogen are the main parts of proteins. That's what the protein backbone is made up of. But what's interesting is that as you move up the food chain from plants to primary consumers to secondary consumers, you get what's known as fractionation occurring. So that's where there is a differential loss of the lighter isotopes. And so what this means is that as you go up each level of the food chain, the kind of proportion of nitrogen-15 that you would find in a kind of bulk sample of their kind of, what do you call it, biomatter, essentially, the nitrogen-15 content of the biomatter gets higher. So what this means is that you can work out from preserved subfossil remains the kind of averaged diet of a particular specimen. And people have done this for lots of Pleistocene mammals. So looking at things like mammoths, reindeer, lions, saber-tooths, dire wolves, all sorts of things to try and figure out who was eating who in the past, which is a pretty useful thing to know if you're interested in reconstructing kind of prehistoric and Pleistocene food webs. Mm-hmm. And people have done this with Neanderthals and also with anatomically modern humans as well from the same time period. And the Neanderthal delta 15 nitrogen values are really enriched. So these are guys that are eating almost nothing but meat, and meat from mammoths, reindeer, woolly rhino, all sorts of the kind of megafauna that would have been in their environment. And a lot of the classic studies that were first done on this were done on Neanderthals from Belgium, from Spy Cave, and they kind of set the scene and are classically very enriched for a meat-heavy diet. And so that's partly confirms the idea that Neanderthals were incredible hunters, were able to live almost entirely off an animal diet with very little kind of vegetable input. I mean, conversely, studies of other Neanderthals from other parts of the world have said something different. So Neanderthals have been looked at from Spain, and in particular, not just with their dietary isotopes, but with things like the DNA found in dental calculus. So dental calculus is basically plaque that forms on your teeth, but it kind of acts as a time capsule for all the bacteria and also some of the food that's in your mouth as well. And it, over the past decade, I think, it's come forward as a really interesting preservative for looking at diet in ancient humans, ancient animals, and also in Neanderthals. And when they looked at calculus in Neanderthals, they looked at them in Neanderthals from Spain, from El Cedron, and they found something quite interesting, which is that these guys didn't seem to be eating a lot of meat. They had a lot of DNA from mushrooms, from plants, and not a very enriched nitrogen value from their bone studies. So it looks like everything human, it differs according to time and place, which is interesting. But something that came out recently, which I will flag up, which I think is really cool, was a paper that came out, I think, just last year, looking at alternative explanations for why Neanderthals might be so enriched in their delta 15 nitrogen values. And they came up with the idea, which, you know, seems fairly obvious when you think about it, but maybe not to people who have a Western diet, which is that maggots are very enriched in nitrogen because they are eating meat. And so if you eat something that's already eating meat, that's going to push your nitrogen values way up. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's not very common in kind of Western anthropological studies of diet, but is common in lots of places around the world. I mean, there are still some vestiges of it in, there's like a certain Corsican cheese, I think, which you eat with filled with live maggots. But ethnographic studies and reports from other parts of the world show that it's very, very common that when you cache meat, which is a necessity when you're not sure where your next hunt is going to be successful, cached meat will 100% develop maggots. Sometimes people cached meat in a particular way so that they would encourage maggots because they were seen as a little snack that you could have just on the go.
Good source of protein, right?
A good source of protein. You know, they're chewy, they're wriggly, slightly fun to eat. So if Neanderthals were caching meat, which we do also have some evidence that they were doing, then it would be highly likely that there would be maggots in that meat, and that the maggots being consumed by the Neanderthals increases their trophic level, you know, another step. So you have the nitrogen values in the plants, you have nitrogen values in, for instance, the deer that are eating the plants, then you'd have the nitrogen values increasing in the maggots that are eating the deer, and then you'd have the nitrogen value increasing from the Neanderthals that are eating the maggots, that have eaten the deer, that have eaten the grass. So it seemed like a really interesting, possibly quite hard to test for, but certainly backed up by ethnographic data that maggots and other kind of insect life might have been a large component of Neanderthal diet.
Yeah, interesting. That's a fascinating idea.
I hadn't heard of that paper.
No, me neither.
So I'll have to find that one to link in the show notes here.
Include that into my course. They also, in the calculus, they also found evidence of medicinal use of herbs and medicines, right? Which gives us a really good insight into like culture behavior of Neanderthals too. That was a fascinating study.
Totally.
In particular, that was a Neanderthal with evidence of a tooth abscess, and there was poplar bark in the calculus, or poplar DNA or poplar microfossils. I'm not sure, but it was poplar that this individual was treating a tooth infection with.
Mm-hmm. And does poplar have salicylic acid in it, like willow?
Yeah, poplar is related to willow. I don't think it's as good as willow, but it would work in the same way.
Mm-hmm. And it's not nutritionally of any use, imagine that.
No, and no. It tastes gross. I've got a jar of poplar bark that I harvested myself. It's super bitter.
What do you do with it, Josh?
I like to learn about plants. I was going to use it for like aspirin. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not a good test case because I don't really feel the effects of drugs anyway. I take an aspirin and then 2 hours later, my headache's gone and I don't know that there's a connection between that. I have like such a poor connection between my brain and my body somehow.
The paper, so it actually came out this year. So the one about Neanderthals, hypercarnivores and maggots, insights from stable nitrogen isotopes is in Science Advances, and it's by Melanie Beasley, Julie Lesnick and John Speth. And it's definitely worth a read.
They do cool work, that group.
Mm.
Cool.
So yeah, for when the long night, they talk about, what was it, gatherer's pie or scavenger's pie?
Scavenger's pie. Yeah.
And there has to be real rotten apricots, not from a can. That's, you know, maybe they were prescient.
Ooh.
They also, one of the jokes I like in this episode, or sort of recurring joke, is that they sort of reveal what Long Night is a little bit at a time, just as a throwaway line, and you sort of have to piece it together. One of the things that they're searching for, I think they said a dried beetle's nest.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I don't know what a beetle's nest is, but if we're talking about them eating bugs, beetles, you know, you could have carrion beetles. You could have another sort of trophic level there. So maybe they accidentally stumbled upon something good there.
And that's where Joel meets Heather and has to invite her because they're both arguing over the last packet of beetle nests.
Yeah, because that's how she got her invite, right? Because she knew it was long night, so she went there knowing that they would need to get this. I tried to slow it down so I could see what the beetle nest looked like. It was in like a little package, but I couldn't really see it. My guess, it's like one of those like cocoony things that bugs, insects make in the ground that they sleep in.
Like a little cocoon.
Yeah.
One more note on Neanderthal diet is one of the sort of recent papers that they did was looking for the oral microbiome from dental calculus. So there's bacteria in your mouth, which has evolved to sort of match the diet that your species eats. So like humans have our own unique oral microbiome, like unique species of bacteria that match us. And they can get the DNA from that bacteria from the dental calculus on teeth, which is crazy what we can do these days.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they found in that study is they got some from Neanderthals, they got modern humans and compared it. And there is DNA of a bacterium that sort of has evolved to produce amylase to digest starches. I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Neanderthals have the same bacterium which has evolved to digest starches that mm-hmm. modern humans do, which suggests this evolved this microbiome evolved before our species split, but it also implies that Neanderthals were eating enough starchy foods to maintain this oral microbiome. So again, it's more evidence that Neanderthals were eating a lot more plants than we assume, because meat doesn't have starches. So mm-hmm. you wouldn't need this microbiome if you're not eating starchy foods and you're only eating meats.
What's really fascinating and has nothing to do with Neanderthals or this episode is that they've traced the change, the shift in the human microbiome, oral microbiome, like through the years, and they're looking at the shift through as we changed into agriculture and then post-agriculture and then industrial age, like up until now. And there's this huge shift in the distribution and prevalence of certain species. And that's why we get so many more dental caries, so cavities, and we have so many more dental diseases than we did. So pre-agriculture, dental cavities and such were kind of a bit rare, like not super rare, but rare. And then now they're, you know, most people have cavities at some point in their lives. If we didn't go to the dentist, we would definitely have cavities. And it's because we're eating these high carb, high sugar foods, but it's not just that we're eating them. It's actually changed. This changing in our foods has changed our oral microbiome. And then the species that we're getting more and more of a prevalence of in our mouth environment is actually the one that causes caries. And you can see, like, in the chart that they show, you can see the number of them just growing and growing and growing throughout time. So it's really fascinating, everything that we can learn.
I think it's also interesting as well when we talk about how do we assess diet in hominids, is that it's much easier with a meat-based diet, because that leaves behind bones, which we can find. We can kind of tabulate and assess and create a hypothesis about. But you know, if people are eating mushrooms and wood sorrel, then that leaves nothing in the fossil record, and almost, you know, very little even in the potential for dental calculus. So there's almost an inherent bias there to presume that ancient peoples were eating an awful lot of meat just because that's the evidence that survives.
Mm-hmm. But I should correct you. It's not no fossil record, because plants have microfossils that we're learning how to identify now. And so there's a few things in particular. One of them is pollen, which is basically plant sperm. But pollen is like very hardy. It'll last for thousands of years. Pollen has famously been used in the Neanderthal burial at Shanidar, which they call the flower burial, which has been kind of controversial. But they found flower pollen mixed into the burial. They sort of initially assumed that was burying the individual with flowers in the grave, but more recently they've decided maybe that's contamination either from rodents digging holes and bringing flowers in to eat, or from a certain type of burrowing bee, which hibernates under the soil. We also have starches themselves, which are pretty hardy, and they can last for a very long time. So we can actually get starches directly from dental calculus.
Also, we can get the residues, chemical residues from pottery and stuff as well, right?
Yeah. So a lot of these things we can get either from dental calculus or from the residues of pottery or stone tools. Neanderthals wouldn't have had pottery, but we can scrape the residues off of the stone tools if they were using them for things like that. And starches, the anthropology lab at the University of Winnipeg has a pretty good facility for identifying starches from dental calculus. It's one of the big things that we do there. I'm not involved in that project in particular, but we have this Caribbean research project where they're identifying the earliest evidence of agriculture in the Caribbean based on starches from dental calculus. And I think they've identified in Cuba the earliest evidence of domesticated beans in Cuba at something like, can't remember, like 6,000 years ago or something like that.
Holy.
Which is pushing the earliest dates for that pretty far back.
Around the time that Cuba loses its ground slots, interestingly.
Interesting. And then the last thing is phytoliths, which are this microscopic silica skeleton that plants have, which are these tiny little, basically shards of glass that sort of wedge in between the cells of most plants, I think. Some plant parts have more phytoliths than others, like grasses have a lot of phytoliths, which is why grass wears down your teeth a lot if you eat it. I guess probably most people don't know that, but like animals that chew a lot of grass, like cattle, you know, they have these teeth that are sort of evolved to wear in a certain way because grass is really abrasive. But starches and phytoliths and pollens are all sort of diagnostic of the type of plant they came from. So these are all things we can get out of dental calculus or tool residues, and we can identify not necessarily the species, but certainly the type of plant that they came from.
Oh.
While we're talking about plants, I was interested in peaches because they're peaches play an important role in their, what do they call it? The forager's pie?
Scavenger's pie, I think, yeah.
Scavenger's pie. And this got me thinking because peaches that we eat today are obviously a domesticate. And I got to thinking I wouldn't associate Neanderthals with peaches. I've never heard of Neanderthals eating peaches. I didn't really know much about peaches, but apparently they were first domesticated in China. I don't really think of peaches as a Chinese domesticate. Especially since the name is Prunus persicus. So the, you know, Linnaeus thought they were domesticated in Persia, but I guess we've since realized that they were domesticated much farther east than that.
Along the Silk Route. I know that they come from a can and they were put there by a man in a factory downtown. Just waiting for that to sail over the heads of anyone from Gen Z or Gen Alpha.
Those young people don't listen to this podcast. Our peak listener, I think, is 35 to 50.
Yeah.
Yeah, so at first I was thinking, oh, so peaches are a domesticated food. It comes from China. This isn't something Neanderthals would be eating.
But, I mean, so is cow.
Yeah, we can talk about the cow, too. I mean, maybe they're eating an aurochs.
I doubt they got aurochs at the supermarket in California.
But I mean,
they're doing what they can do, right?
Yeah.
In the Long Night Story, does it not say that the cow gives them all milk?
Yeah, it is the cow. So,
yeah.
Did they say milk? I wasn't really here. I actually wrote down the whole story here. Do you want to hear the entire story that they tell at the end?
Yes. Yeah.
In the time before shoes, beyond the wall of mountains. Well, actually, we could comment on that, too, because I believe we have Neanderthal footprints that have some sort of foot wrap, if not like a hard-soled shoe, but like some sort of leather wrapping on them, possibly. I'd have to look into that, but I feel like we talked about that on another episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the time before shoes, beyond the wall of mountains, there was a winter colder than any winter before, and on the coldest, darkest, longest night, the cavemen were barely clinging to life. They were hungry, and between them, they had but one cow to eat. And as the night wore on, more and more people appeared at the cave. Friends, family, strangers, and even worst enemies. All cold, all starving, all desperate for something. I listened to this word several times. I could not figure out what he said. It sounds like succor. All desperate for succor. The cavemen could have sent them away, but they didn't. They opened their hearts, and this is what saved their lives, because the warmth of all those bodies pressing together in the cave kept them alive. And from that day until the end of days, so shall it be. Long live Long Night. To the cow.
I mean, I guess it's not that these are Neanderthals that have woken up like Isino Man. These are Neanderthals or cavemen that have, like they say, they've been there the start of the show. Yeah, so I guess that they're the prehistoric cow ancestor would have changed to the word cow as they've developed into the modern world with us, right? And they would have changed it, whatever the fruit was, to peaches. And
yeah,
I guess it makes sense.
I think it's what's also interesting as well is that it's not just like their story of a cow that miraculously lasts long enough to feed everyone also kind of reflects sort of Hanukkah tradition as well, with the lamb oil lasting long enough as well. So they've made it nicely non-denominational, so it's not just a kind of pastiche of Christmas, but also of Hanukkah as well.
Yeah, that's true.
But I also read the only one cow between them as a joke about Neanderthals being starving and eating lots of food, because one cow is not a small amount of food. So I didn't see this as, oh, they only had one cow for all these people. It was, they had way more than enough food, but they're just Neanderthals, so they just love eating tons of food. And so they would act as if one cow is not a lot of food. Because obviously at the party they have way more meat than they need for the amount of people there, right?
Yeah. I like their decorations too. So their decorations were all like the dried grass and the like mud and a lot of outdoorsy stuff. Yeah, it's almost like the holly and the mistletoe and all that stuff, but more of like a cavey, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Like a Christmas feel. Tree.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how I like to do, me and Aurora like to do our house here, with as much sort of natural stuff as we can. We made we dry orange slices in the food dehydrator and then put a string on them and hang
them.
Stuff like that.
A good Christmas tree decoration, me and Bridie made some like 20 years ago, but if you get walnuts and you open them carefully so that they don't like fly into a million bits, you can glue them back together and paint them gold, and they make nice little kind of hanging baubles.
That's nice. You could put like a bell or something in them so they jingle.
Yeah, you could do that.
Nice. All of our Christmas stuff is very much from the 80s, handmade things that we like, the clay stuff and
a lot of tinsel.
A lot of tinsel. Yeah, anything that the cat didn't eat and throw up. And my mom has these beautiful like stars and all these beautiful things that she's gotten throughout the years to put on the top of the tree, but every year we always just put this like dollar store little paper angel that my parents got like the first Christmas that they were together or something like that. And we loved it. And it's so like flimsy looking and everything, but yeah, we love it. I don't know if there's anything natural about the Christmas, like the trees, plastic, and it's all very 80s still.
Well, another thing we can talk about is solstice, from a cultural point of view or from a astronomical point of view. Obviously, long night, it must be the actual winter solstice, or we should say the December solstice, because obviously the winter solstice is going to be in June in the southern hemisphere, and et cetera. So to prepare for this, I was reading the Wikipedia page on solstice, and like a good nerd, I'm interested in astronomy and space and all kinds of stuff. But every time I try to read about it, I'm sort of confronted with how little I actually understand it properly, because I'm reading about solstice and I keep getting all these words that I don't understand. So I have to go down these Wikipedia rabbit holes and follow up. What does this word mean? What is declension? What is the celestial equator? What is not declension, declination? And trying to piece it all back together. So maybe we want to talk a little bit about what the solstice is from an astronomical point of view. Is that worth talking about, or does everybody know what the solstice is?
Yeah, no, not yourself.
I don't think I've ever thought about it. I have no idea. It's something that happens.
Good. Well, the solstice is, well, there's two solstices and two equinoxes. And so there's a solstice that occurs around June 21st. And actually, I didn't realize this shifts a slightly year to year. It's not exactly the same day. And I guess this is because of the way we organize our year with leap years, because a year is actually 365.24 days or something like that.
Why do humans do this to themselves?
It's not our fault. Why did the universe do this to us?
Yeah, that's just actually how long it takes the sun to go, or the earth to go around the sun, right? It actually, the earth takes not a perfect amount of days to go around the sun. So if we didn't have that fraction of a day that we add up every 4 years, then the year would drift. It would drift 1 day every 4 years.
But does that
matter?
Over
long time scales, this would.
Yeah, unless you want to have
because eventually
December.
Christmas would be in the summer. Yeah. And I believe that actually did happen with older calendars, didn't it?
Yeah, right? It happened with the Julian calendar.
That's why, like, Orthodox Christmas is like 2 weeks away from non-Orthodox, whatever standard Christmas. What do we call non-Orthodox Christmas?
Pagan Christmas?
No. Western Christmas, maybe? I don't know.
Western Christmas?
Western Church.
Catholic Christmas. And Protestant and other denominations of Christianity Christmas.
Reformed Christmas? I don't know.
Yeah, so anyway, the Earth takes so long to go around the sun, and the equinoxes and the solstices happen because of the angle of the axis that the Earth rotates around. What do we call that angle? The something angle?
I'm just getting flashbacks to elementary school. Googling.
There's the precession, and there's also the axis.
Yeah.
Maybe we're losing all of our astronomy nerds on this episode with a bunch of archaeologists and paleontologists trying to describe astronomy. The Earth's axis is slightly angled relative to the plane that it rotates around that it orbits the sun.
Yes.
And that angle is sort of constant. So as the Earth goes around the sun, the angle is always sort of pointing in the same direction relative to the solar system, which means that at a certain point in the orbit, the northern hemisphere is tilted towards the sun. And at the other end of the orbit, the southern hemisphere is tilted towards the sun. And this is why the length of the day, the length of the sunlight hours, differs season to season. So the equinoxes are the point of the year in the orbit where the nighttime is equal to the daylight hours. And the solstices are the points of the year where either the nighttime or the daylight hours are at their longest. And the word solstice comes from the Latin words sol for sun and sistere, which is to stand still. So this is the point where the sun's declination, this is the angle that the sun appears in the sky at its highest point in the day. Throughout the fall, that's getting lower and lower. The sun is getting lower and lower in the sky at its highest point during the day. And at the solstice, that motion stands still and then reverses. So after the solstice, the sun starts to get higher and higher in the sky at midday. And there's apparently an older English word, sunstead, which means the same thing. Instead of solstice, sunstead, where the sun comes to a stead, to a standstill. And so it's kind of interesting to me that in modern humans, we refer to the solstice by the sun's movement, but the cavemen refer to long night instead. They're focusing on the length of the night rather than the length of the position of the sun.
Mm.
And I guess the sun is more accurate because night is, you know, the sun is an actual thing and the night is just sort of an artifact of what the sun is doing, right?
But it was in the night that almost killed them, so.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have called it short day, I suppose.
Yeah.
So this is, I guess, like going back to what Josh was saying, this is when, if you see someone take like a daily photo of the sun from the same spot throughout the year, then it kind of traces a figure of eight shape in the sky. And so at which point then is the solstice? It's a point at its furthest and lowest right, probably, before it kind of shifts back. I don't know.
I don't know about the figure eight motion, but it is whatever point is the lowest point in the sky.
Right.
Only between the tropics and the Arctic or Antarctic circles, though, that's important because in the tropics, the lowest point of the sun in the sky is slightly different for some reason I didn't understand. And in the Arctic Circle, of course, there's a period of time above the Arctic Circle and below the Antarctic Circle. There's a period of time where the sun never sets. And so the solstices only really occur during in between the tropics and the Arctic and Antarctic circles. And then, of course, they're backwards in the northern and southern hemispheres. So the winter solstice is in December in the northern hemisphere, but the winter solstice is in June in the southern hemisphere.
Okay. So I've just looked up what I was blathering about before, and apparently it's called an analemma.
Great. More Wikipedia rabbit holes to go down to understand the basics of the sun.
So it is a diagram showing the position of the sun in the sky as seen from a fixed location on Earth at the same mean solar time over the course of a year. The change of position is a result of the shifting of the angle in the sky of the path that the sun takes in respect to the stars, the ecliptic. The north-south component of the analemma results from the change in the sun's declination due to the tilt of Earth's axis of rotation as it orbits around the sun. There you go.
Perfect.
I think we've lost the astrology nerds and the archaeologists now.
We've still got the astrologists, though.
You think? Or you think they've given up on us?
It's going to be like when I listen to podcasts from other scientists when they cover archaeology, and I'm like, oh, yeah, you're trying your best.
Yeah. We'll get you did your best ribbon.
But please don't talk about it again. We're going to be, like, our episode's going to be featured on some astrology science communication where they talk about the, like, popular science that does it wrong. They're going to be like, this is what they said wrong.
Astronomy, Kim, not astrology. Did you say astrology?
Oh,
I said astrology. Because they'll still be listening.
Astrology, yes.
Astronomy is, like I said, one of these things that I'm very interested in, but I never really had, I don't think I've ever taken an astronomy course in university. I took cosmology, which was very interesting, but it wasn't really astronomy. But like, I'm super interested. I love looking up at the sky. I love, you know, all kinds of astronomy stuff. I love space. I love, like, watching the space station when it's in the sky at night. But it's one of these things that I always am confronted with how poorly I understand it. Because, like, a year or so ago, Aurora and I were, like, looking at the moon, and we're like, how does the moon work? And we're, like, we're looking it up and, like, oh, yeah, that all makes perfect sense. And yet it's slightly more complicated than I somehow imagined it was, right? Like,
yeah, I mean,
why does the full moon always rise at the same spot in the sky?
We're taught the very basics.
It's a bit more complicated than that. It could be a scientist's mantra.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, why does the sun follow this figure eight pattern? You know, I get the idea that it's, like, low in the sky at the solstice and then high in the sky at the other solstice, but why this sort of angled figure eight pattern? That's something that I'm still not quite 100% on.
It's just a simulation. Doesn't matter.
That's your answer for everything, Kim. No. We're starting to sound a little bit like Roger from Ghosts with the Moonstone.
Yes.
Is it Roger? Have I forgotten his name?
Robin.
Robin, sorry. Yeah, Robin from Ghosts and the Moonstone.
Related to astronomy and archaeology again, one of the things I always found really interesting is the ancient Greeks knew that the Earth is a sphere, right? Mm-hmm. They knew the Earth was round, but they didn't understand that the planets and the Earth were orbiting the sun rather than the sun and the planets orbiting the Earth like all the stars do, right? Mm-hmm. So because the Earth rotates, it appears that the stars rotate around the Earth and they just go in straight circles around the Earth, and the math for that is really easy to figure out. But the sun and the planets do these figure eights in the sky. And that was one of the things that didn't make sense, because if they're orbiting the Earth, why do they make these weird little loops? And so when you realize that actually the Earth and the planets are just orbiting the sun, again, it's just circles and the math is pretty easy. But because they hadn't figured that out, they did these crazy complicated calculations to make the math work, to make the sun and the planets do this. And I believe it's the Antikythera mechanism, which is one of these fun things that pseudo-archaeologists like to talk about, which is basically a simple computer, which they discovered on a Greek shipwreck in the early 1900s. They didn't really realize what it was for a while, and it's missing some parts, but it's sort of this mechanical clockwork computer thing, which is basically an orrery which is a representation of the universe or the solar system, like one of these elementary school projects where you make a solar system with the Earth and the planets going around the sun. But they basically could like calculate all of these celestial events into the future with this simple computer. And if I'm not mistaken, they believe it had these complex calculations to account for the weird movement of the planets and the sun built into it, because they didn't recognize that they're just going in circles around the sun rather than orbiting around the Earth. Mm. Which I always found so interesting that they knew the Earth was a sphere, but they didn't realize the sun is the center of the solar system. So they made this complicated math to account for something where the math actually should have been pretty simple if they just realized their mistake.
Mm. Yeah, but you would think that, like, I don't know, humans tend to think that we're the center, right? It's very
mm-hmm.
true.
Andrew Kinkella does a really good episode on that, on his podcast, Pseudo Archaeology, if anybody wants to learn more about
it. On the Antikythera mechanism?
Yeah.
Cool. We'll link that in the show notes. Oh, one last thing in my notes here. They have one of these sort of throwaway lines where they're sort of giving you a piece of their Long Night celebration. We mentioned this already. They were buying a beef tongue that was supposed to go in the punch. And this made me think of this recipe that started floating around early in the pandemic when everyone was bored of beef fizz. Did you guys see that floating around Twitter at the time?
No. What is it?
It's a recipe for a drink from like the 1950s or 60s. And the backstory here is, I think, from Campbell's Soup. In the 1950s, there was one summer that was like extra hot and nobody wanted to eat hot soup. So Campbell's is like, how can we sell more soup? Oh, well, we'll give them a bunch of recipes for cold soup, basically. And so beef fizz is a can of beef bouillon mixed with ginger ale and lemon.
Ew.
Served cold. And I believe that this probably originated with like a Campbell's Soup campaign to try and sell more soup in the hot summer month. There's also another line in the episode where they describe a drink, which is one part beef bouillon and nine parts grain alcohol. And
you're not tasting the beef at that point. It's just burning. Right?
We can talk about this idea of Neanderthals having grain alcohol at all. We've talked about alcohol in other episodes, but we don't really get real grain alcohol until we have agriculture because you need to have a source of grain. You need to be sedentary so that you can leave your grain in a pot of water for a few weeks to get it to ferment. So probably Neanderthals or any Paleolithic people didn't really have a brewing system, you know, before we get to agriculture.
Mm.
But certainly they'd have found fermented fruits, like just naturally fermenting, and have used those. Yeah. And I guess, yeah, it takes till agriculture to get kind of brewing, but like distilled alcohol, that's much later. That's not till, I guess, has to be at least post-Iron Age when you have metalworking that would be able to make stills and distilling apparatus.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. That's within the last 1,000 years, possibly. Like, distilling is pretty, pretty new.
Mm.
Well, that's about all my notes. Does anybody have anything else to say about this episode?
No, I'm about to pass out.
That's up from your one part beef bouillon and nine parts grain alcohol. I'll sort you right out.
Grace.
Well, happy solstice, everybody.
Happy long night.
Happy long night. And everything else you may celebrate in this season.
Do you have questions, comments, or movie requests? We want to hear from you. Find us on Blue Sky and Facebook at SOTSA Podcast. Send us an email to screensofthestoneage@gmail.com or visit our website at screensofthestoneage.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.